Our third case for December, 12AP337, State v. Mohammed Sarfraz. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Daniel J. O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Generally, a sexual assault victim's sexual history is not admissible to prove the victim's consent or lack of credibility in a Wisconsin sexual assault trial. The trial judge has virtually no discretion in the matter. That has been the law in this state for decades. It is embodied in Section 972.11, paren 2, sub B and sub C of the Wisconsin statutes. The legislature has carved out but three narrow exceptions to that general exclusionary rule, one of which is at issue here, sub 2B1, evidence of the victim's sexual history with the defendant. But even then, the trial judge's discretion is greatly circumscribed by the legislature because in Section 971.31(11), the legislature said that that evidence remains inadmissible unless the defendant proves three things. The prior conduct with the defendant did in fact occur, at least a reasonable person could so conclude. Number two, that those prior acts were material to an issue of fact at trial, and that the prior acts are so probative that they outweigh their presumed prejudicial impact. That rule, embodied in 972.11, has been affirmed of and approved of by this Court on numerous occasions over those decades. The trial judge acted reasonably here, and the Court of Appeals failed to appreciate the environment that he was operating in when he excluded evidence of the prior sexual conduct between the defendant and the victim. The Court of Appeals failed to appreciate the significance of the legislative strictures on the judge's exercise of discretion and the judge's thorough, reasonable exercise of discretion within those strictures. The judge concluded that Mr. Sarfraz failed to meet his burden of proving materiality and sufficient probative value to outweigh prejudicial impact, even assuming those prior acts occurred as he said they had. The judge so concluded because Mr. Sarfraz failed to present a sufficient evidentiary hypothesis rooted in fact that tended to prove the evidentiary theory he wanted the jury to adopt. What was that hypothesis? I point to two parts of this transcript. One, the pretrial evidentiary hearing on the motion in limine to admit this evidence, which is the November 29, 2010 hearing. It's over 100 pages of transcript. It includes Mr. Sarfraz's testimony, his wife's testimony, and his friend's testimony. Throughout that transcript, the judge tried to draw it from defense counsel what the precise evidentiary hypothesis was. To distill it down to what I think it actually is, I point to pages 8 and 9, page 20, and pages 94 and 96 of that transcript, which is document 59 in the record. In essence, he offered it for two purposes: to prove that she consented to sexual intercourse with Mr. Sarfraz on May 15, 2010, and to prove, in the words of defense counsel, the, quote, nature of their relationship, close quote. To distill it even further, I point to the first sentence of counsel's closing argument to the jury at the close of trial, in which counsel said, this case comes down to credibility of witnesses, quote, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. That is, in essence, what he offered the prior sex acts to prove at trial. The trial judge said that was not enough because the trial judge did not see what the rational connection was between the prior acts as alleged by Mr. Sarfraz, although completely denied by the victim, and the violent confrontation and sexual encounter on May 15, 2010 in the victim's apartment.
Mr. O'Brien, we generally, but not always, take cases because there's an interesting issue of law presented. And so what is the interesting law issue that's presented in this case that we should decide? Because as I read the case, the parties agree that the legal principles are set forth in the two statutes that you quoted, and that they also agree that the two primary cases are DeSantis and Jackson. And then another important case is Polizano. And so each you as representing the state and counsel for the defendant differ as to how to apply these cases. And, of course, every fact situation is different. So what's the legal principle here that you want this court to establish that we haven't previously established or needs to be reestablished?
Well, I think that last point, the reestablishment, reestablish the import of the rape shield law. As I argued in my petition for review, it's the state's belief that the decision of the Court of Appeals does violence to the strictures of the rape shield law that has been repeatedly upheld by this court over the years.
Well, they don't declare the rape shield statute unconstitutional.
I'm sorry?
The Court of Appeals does not declare the rape shield law unconstitutional.
As applied, and it did issue a published decision in this case, so this decision is the law of the state with respect to this particular exception to the rape shield law.
Okay, so what's the exception? I'm trying to narrow in on what has to be fixed. You can't just say it's erroneous exercise of discretion, but hey, you think it? Well, there was no erroneous exercise of discretion. What is it that has to be fixed?
There are two things. That this court needs to reassert that generally this type of evidence isn't admissible unless you set forth a sufficient evidentiary hypothesis, which was not done here, and the Court of Appeals did not sufficiently lay forth an evidentiary hypothesis that would undermine the trial judge's discretionary decision. So there's a second area of law here, too, that the Court of Appeals did not properly defer to what is essentially what is manifestly a discretionary decision, whether to admit or exclude evidence. And it basically has told future trial judges when applying this exception, basically let it in when a victim says, well, when the defendant shows it proves consent and it proves the nature of our relationship up to that point without more. And that, to me, operates as a de facto rule of law for future trial judges, that the rape shield law tells trial judges generally this does not get in. The presumptions are against admissibility, where the decision of the Court of Appeals basically flips that and says, no, this generally gets in unless there's absolutely nothing
to
support it.
Where does the Court of Appeals say that?
Well, I guess I would I don't know if they specifically say that they're overruling the rape shield law, but that is, in fact, what happens. And I think that is pointed out.
No, you just lost a case.
Well, I think it was just pointed out eloquently by Judge Brennan in her dissent, where she explains that they did not defer to the trial judge's discretion, that they did not account for the flipped balancing test in the rape shield law.
The flipped balancing test.
On the probative value and prejudice.
Yeah. Okay, component. What's the regular balancing test?
Under 90403 evidence is admissible unless its probative value is substantially outweighed by prejudice, where under the rape shield law, prejudice is presumed, and you have to show that the evidence is so probative that it outweighs that presumed prejudice. That's quite a difference. And I think it's clear not only from the legislative history and the plain language of the statute, but also from Professor Blinka's article on this statute, that the legislature said this doesn't get in. It's presumed this doesn't get in unless you make a specific, strong evidentiary showing that it does, and that this is ultimately a discretionary act by the trial judge that should not be disturbed by an appellate court.
Well, what about the trial court saying that that you can let this in even though the prior conduct was not violent? Isn't that what the Court of Appeals says? And the trial court says, oh, no, no, you can't do that. Trial court says, can't let it in unless it's the same or substantially the same.
Which is what this court's cases generally hold, that the more similar, the more probative. Where here, this right. is greatly dissimilar conduct, nonviolent, loving conduct as opposed to violent, brutal conduct, and contact as opposed to intercourse, lots of variations. And he never, in his offer of proof, either at the pretrial hearing or when the issue was raised again on a couple of occasions during trial, adequately explained how one is probative of the other. How does one predict the other? How does one portend what happened on May 15, even assuming his version of the events is true?
Well, do you agree with the trial court that says to determine materiality, we have three elements in the state that the state had to prove? I'm on page 107 of the Court of Appeals opinion, quoting the trial court. The state has to prove sexual contact. They have to prove that it was without consent. And they have to prove it was forcibly done. And the prior sexual relationship between these parties is not material to all three of these elements. It might be material to one of them, but not to all three. So I read this to say, for material, it has to be all three elements. Otherwise, it's out. Do you agree with that? Is that what the state wants this court to write?
Well, I think it's problematic because it's hard to separate out these things. What happened on May 15th involved all three elements. You can't parse out the consent from the force, from the use of a dangerous weapon. This was all one continuous event. So to that extent, I'm not sure that that's a correct analysis to say, well, even though it's admissible on two, it's not admissible on one, therefore it's not admissible.
That was the trial court's reasoning.
But I think it's more of a correct analysis if you're looking at the third prong with regard to how probative is this. And it might be probative on one or two elements, but it's certainly not probative on the other. And that's made, and the fourth element is critical here because this was all the sexual intercourse occurred either immediately after or during the forceful conduct was ongoing. And that's not disputed, Mr. Sarfraz, by the way.
Where did the trial court make that balance? I thought that there was significantly lacking in the trial court of making a balance of probative value and prejudice.
Well, you know, I think it's convenient for the Court of Appeals to parse out part of the trial judge's ruling. That transcript was 110 pages, and throughout that transcript, the trial judge is trying to draw out from counsel what exactly is your evidentiary hypothesis. And he never really gave him he said, well, it's consent and it's the nature of the relationship. That's
well,
at bottom what he said.
He said consent and he said credibility.
Well,
and the consent went to the issue of a cultural factor in relationships, and credibility went to the fact that these two people had totally different versions of what happened in that apartment. Right?
Well, not totally different. No. They both agreed this was a very violent encounter.
That's right.
And
they did.
But even if you believe Mr. Sarfraz's version of the violence, the mutual loving masturbation that occurred during a romantic relationship did nothing to portend that violence.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, this goes to the Chief Justice's question of a couple minutes ago, two questions ago, and you had made reference to this about 5 or 7 minutes ago, and I'm looking at page 7 of the Court of Appeals decision, and it goes to the Chief Justice's original question, do you agree with the trial court judge that three things have to be demonstrated, and then you responded along the lines of, I think it goes more to the probative nature. And the circuit court is saying, at paragraph 12, one, and the defendant must show me these three things, that the proffered evidence relates to sexual activities between the complainant and the defendant. I've already ruled that a reasonable jury could believe that there was a sexual relationship between the two of them. However, when we start talking about materiality, which could be a synonym for probative, what the defendant is accused of here is a rape, a forcible rape. None of the sexual contact, and I assume here he means prior to the incident, which brings us here today, none of the sexual contact between the defendant and the victim involved that. Even if I accept it at its face value that it's true, what it involved at was sexual contact, a masturbating of the defendant to ejaculation by the victim's hand. So that kind of, does that go to probativeness? Does that go to the factors?
I think it goes to both. It goes to materiality, the second prong, the materiality. Again, he's got the burden of proof. He's got to convince the trial judge why this proves the other. And the probative value is limited because we are talking about a violent sexual encounter, and he's got to prove how this loving mutual masturbation during a romantic relationship proves or disproves that. Then also the third prong, how much weight does that probative value, that really that insufficient showing of probative value have on balance with the legislatively presumed prejudice? And I think the trial judge's analysis, as you point out throughout, the judge is combining the facts here, the facts of the force as well as the act, the sexual act, and the nature of the conduct alleged. And, again, the nature of the conduct conceded by Mr. Sarfraz in his trial testimony, where he got on the stand and said, yes, we had a violent encounter, but she's the one who came at me. She's the one who insisted on the sex. She's the one who attacked me. She's the one who pulled a knife. She's the one I had a death struggle with. And then she laid down on the floor and placated me and agreed to sex. How does that prior act predict that? And I think that's all going through the trial judge's analysis. And the judge said, no, you haven't proven your case. Could he have articulated it better? Sure. He's deciding from the bench. He's not writing it out. He's doing the best he can after a lengthy argument, after 100 pages of testimony, and he's looking at prior acts that involve nonviolence, that involve mutuality, that involve love, that involve agreed-upon non-vaginal intercourse, and then he's looking at a violent encounter that, from any perspective, just came out of nowhere, and saying, you haven't proven your evidentiary hypothesis. You haven't done it. And I just take issue with the Court of Appeals, what I think is the conclusion that he erred as a matter of law in applying the rape shield law.
Mr. O'Brien, funny if I might interrupt for just a minute. The Court of Appeals never applied a harmless error analysis. Well, let's just assume for a minute that there's error by the circuit judge. Do you think this case could be resolved by applying a harmless error analysis here?
Well, to be honest with you, we probably wouldn't be here if the Court of Appeals had applied the harmless error analysis.
So that means yes.
Because, and I think you're, yes, it can't, it should, to answer your question, yes. We made the harmless error argument. You know, I want to make that clear. We made a harmless error argument with respect to both the rape shield and the confrontation issues and explained why there is such compelling physical evidence to render harmless any evidentiary error.
Made it in the Court of Appeals or here or both?
I'm sorry?
You made the harmless error
argument. We made the harmless error argument in the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
About a four-page argument in the brief, very similar to the argument I'm making here. And as this Court stated in State v. Harvey, even if we hadn't made that argument, paragraph 47, note 12 of the seminal Harvey case on harmless error, that the harmless error rule, 805.18 sub 2, is an injunction on the Court to address the issue of harmless error even when the State doesn't raise it. But we raise it here. So it was incumbent. The Court of Appeals was required to reach that issue, and it didn't do it, which is another legal error that merits this Court's review. And had it reached it, it would have been, we believe, it is hard to find a case where error is less harmful, where they found the knife in his cab, where he lied about how he sustained his injuries, claiming that he was beaten by two black men in his cab, where she scrawled his initials in blood on a newspaper and on a cabinet in her apartment while he's attacking her, where she suffers blunt force trauma to her vagina, where his DNA is inside her vagina, where his clothes are covered in blood, where they're both injured, where the knife is found hidden in his cab, all of those. Harvey says beyond a reasonable doubt was the error harmless. I dare say beyond any doubt in this case, because not only that, but because the trial judge, let's not forget, did allow in the exercise of his discretion, did allow the defendant to put in proof that they had developed a romantic relationship that even got to the point of allowing hugs and kisses. And they allowed him to put on a witness, his friend, who said he saw them in compromising positions on the couch and in the kitchen. And his wife testified that she found them alone in the bedroom and she got enraged and made the victim move out of the house. That all got in. So the jury had plenty with which to accept his reasonable inference the inference he has to draw, which I don't believe is reasonable, that therefore, because they had this romantic relationship, she was a scorned woman and she attacked him on May 15th.
Was it error to put in that evidence?
Was
it error to allow the defendant to put it in? If the judge is right, it's not material for him to put in more evidence of it. Was it error for the trial court to put in the evidence that...
I would say that it's a reasonable exercise of discretion because, as the trial judge said, this is not sexual conduct. The rape shield law specifically outlaws prior sexual conduct, where hugging and kissing, or in one instance the witness said that he was feeding her in the kitchen or vice versa. That's not sexual conduct. Now, you can infer that maybe there's something going on here beneath the surface, but... and a jury might have done that. But that is, I think it's reasonable for a trial judge to say, look, he does have a constitutional right to present a defense. I'm going to allow that much in because it's not sexual conduct, but I'm not going to let you allow in the actual sexual conduct because...
So it's not redundant if he put in more evidence because there wasn't really original evidence in the trial of sexual contact.
No, there was never of the prior sexual contact?
Yes.
No, it was never. It never came in. The defendant's wife's testimony came close, but she didn't cross the line. And otherwise, it was all about this supposed hugging and kissing. And then he testified about how this romantic relationship developed and continued over time. And so again, I think, as this court in Jackson talked about. Now, in that case, consent ultimately was not an issue, but the theory of admissibility was the same. She's falsely accusing me of forcible sexual assault because we developed this relationship behind my girlfriend's back, and we had a disagreement, and now she's a jealous and scorned lover, and that's why she is making up this story of sexual violence. Well, that's pretty much the same theory that's being offered here. And it just doesn't cold water. It just doesn't provide. The theory is great, but there's got to be a rational link between the prior conduct and the current conduct. And there wasn't any in Sullivan, and there certainly wasn't any here. And again, even assuming Mr. Sarfraz's version of what happened in her apartment is true, when you read his testimony, this was something that really no one saw coming. And I'm sure he didn't see it coming if it was true, because the nature of their relationship was such in the past, he was in control. I'm sorry, I see my red light is on.
Finish your thought.
Well, in the past, he was in control. He initiated the hugs and kisses, according to his pretrial testimony. He initiated the masturbation, encouraged her, even though she said, I've never done this sort of thing before, to touch him. And then all of a sudden, on May 15th, she's the one in control. She's the violent one. She's the aggressor. She's the one who's demanding sex. One does not prove the other. The trial judge reasonably found.
I have one other question, and this relates to your reply brief. I read your reply brief as saying that you don't have to have a special consideration of whether or not the particular case supersede, whether or not that in the particular case the defendant's right to present a defense has been interfered with. And then, because you tend to, as I read it, if you've satisfied the rape shield law and the statutes here, the end.
Well, if you fail to meet your burden of proving materiality and sufficient probative value to outweigh prejudice, then the end. And I think the Supreme Court would agree with that, especially after the recent Nevada v. Jackson case. He's got the burden. If he doesn't meet his burden, then he hasn't proven a Confrontation Clause violation either.
Why doesn't the Pulizzano test apply here?
I think in Burns, this Court said the Pulizzano test is a fourth exception to the rape shield law. We have the three legislative exceptions, including the prior contact with the defendant. But the Pulizzano is a fourth, and so that goes more to sexual contact with third parties. The 2B1, created by the legislature, refers to sexual contact with the defendant, and we have a three-part test adopted by this Court in DeSantis and in Jackson. That's the test that applies. Now, if we're trying to get in evidence such as Pulizzano evidence of, like, prior sexual experience of a child to disprove sexual assault committed by the defendant, the prior sexual experience of a child with a third party, then the Pulizzano factors kick in. But even if they do apply here, which I again insist that they don't, but if they do, that hardly helps Mr. Sarfraz, because there it's plain that there's got to be similarity between the prior acts and the current acts. Again, that's totally missing here.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. You have 5 minutes. Rebuttal. Mr. Luchak, Attorney Luchak, representing the defendant.
May it please the Court, Madam Chief Justice, Justices. I'm Jason Luchak, and I represent the defendant respondent, Mohammed Sarfraz. I believe it's very important to note at the outset that I believe that in the state's argument that the interpretation of the ruling that the trial court made in, as Chief Justice Abrahamson pointed out, in saying that it has to be material to all three of the elements of the crime is clear an error in the application of the law. That is simply not what this court has held in Jackson and DeSantis. And that error then allows the Court of Appeals to apply the facts that were found by the trial court to the laws and the test that this court has set forth in Jackson and DeSantis. And I think that it's very important to note that in this case, this was a case that came down to essentially a credibility battle between whose version of events do you believe? There are only two people that were in that apartment when this alleged sexual assault occurred. And it was incredibly important to be able to understand for the jurors the entirety and the nature of the relationship that Mr. Sarfraz had with the complaining witness in this case. It was incredibly material to their consideration, and in fact, a juror even asked a question. The trial court was taking questions of the jurors after Mr. Sarfraz testified, and the juror was wanted to know what the nature and whether there was a prior sexual relationship between Mr. Sarfraz and the complaining witness. And based on the trial court's earlier evidentiary ruling, that question was not asked. So it was obviously something that, at the very least, one juror had in mind as being something that was important and critical to understanding the facts as both versions of events that you heard and which version of events do you believe. So ultimately, the error that occurred in the trial court essentially not only caused the Rape Shield Act to act as a shield to bar this evidence, but it also acted much like a sword because it cut Mr. Sarfraz off basically at the knees from being able to argue that there was a relationship that went beyond just the most modest forms of intimacy, because the trial court did not allow any evidence. And in fact, during the testimony of Mr. Sarfraz's wife, the trial court stopped the trial from going forward and had an in-chambers discussion where he, in fact, did not even allow. There was this incident where Mrs. Sarfraz walked in on Mr. Sarfraz and the complaining witness in bed together, and they were naked from the waist down. That evidence was never considered, even though it likely doesn't even fall under the sexual conduct that the Rape Shield Law is, the definition of the Rape Shield Law. So it's very important that these arguments that relate to this doing harm or doing an injustice to the Rape Shield Act is vastly overstated, because we must remember that the legislature not only enacted the general bar against that evidence, but it enacted the three exceptions. And without those exceptions having meaning, you do run into issues where a defendant's right to present a defense and confront witnesses is vastly lessened and is really does harm to the fairness of the trial in general.
What element or defense to the crime did you believe this evidence was relevant to, and why?
Your Honor, this evidence was relevant, and it was relevant to consent. And the issue was framed that way because the trial court was concerned with what elements does this evidence relate to. So while it relates ultimately to whether the sexual act was consensual that occurred on the date in question, it is the inferential links that go into explaining why you could believe Mr. Sarfraz's testimony over that of the complaining witness. And what I mean by that is his version of events was vastly different than the complaining witness, but his version of events was consistent with the physical evidence. So it really came down to his version was that he had regularly been over to her house. So it was not strange that he would be over at the house, over at her apartment. So it's not surprising that the complaining witness in this case had to put a mask on Mr. Sarfraz, a mask that, by the way, was never found. The police never found a mask. So in order for her story to make sense and to get him into the apartment without there being questions of, well, why was he there in the first place? And Mr. Sarfraz's version of what happened in the apartment was that there was an argument that took place over whether he would leave his wife for her, and he had been making promises to her that he was going to be doing so. They also argued over money. The complaining witness says that that did not happen. A struggle and an attack basically initiated by the complaining witness, according to Mr. Sarfraz, then occurred. Then after the heated argument ended and there was some physical back and forth, that was when the consensual sexual intercourse occurred. So understanding the actual nature and the things that led up to that tumultuous argument, and that what happened in that apartment, and remember, there's only two people that, who were going to testify to that, and Mr. Sarfraz was not even able to rebut the complaining witness's testimony that this was nothing more than a brother-sister relationship. So not only did the rape shield law and the application of it at the trial court's ruling not only not allow him to get in evidence that was related to that, but it allowed him to not even be able to rebut her testimony in a real or any sort of effective way that they did have a close, intimate relationship with each other, that they did argue over whether they were going to get married or not, that that was something that they had even talked about. And it seems far less plausible that if the jurors did not hear that testimony, that Mr. Sarfraz goes from appearing as though he without that testimony, he looks like he is somebody who just has unrequited love for the complaining witness. So this really, the harm that occurred in this case is that the jurors were not presented with the full picture. And so that is why it was relevant. And also then goes into the third factor, which is the probative nature of this.
Now, didn't he testified in his own defense, correct?
Correct.
So the jury heard his testimony about what happened that day.
Correct.
And the jury also heard other testimony about finding the, wasn't the knife found hidden in his cab that was the knife at issue?
It was in his cab, yes.
Uh-huh. So the jury heard that as well. And they did hear that they'd had a friendly relationship, that she and her dad resided in his home for a number of months, correct?
Correct.
See, I think, you know, the piece that was missing for the trial court is if you have a friendly relationship that maybe gets to be inappropriate for a married man and a single woman to be having, how does that get you to a violent sexual encounter where she's bruised after the interaction and where the knife that was at issue was found in his cab? I think that's the problem the trial court had and why it thought it wasn't material to showing consent, which I assume you're telling me now is what was argued to the trial court, too.
Correct. And I want to be clear, Your Honor, that the issue of consent, really, the if we take a step back, this argument that the state makes that it has to be the same or substantially similar conduct in order to be material, that may factor in if the argument relating to consent is that the complaining witness had consented to these other prior sexual acts with the defendant, and the therefore then she must have consented to the sexual act that occurred that led to the charged conduct. That's not the case here. The proponent of the evidence was offering it for something much more than just that propensity type argument. The proponent of the evidence was offering it, and that really is where I believe that the defense and state really differ on this point, is that the state's argument hinges on pigeonholing that this is an issue of consent and goes to that propensity type argument, which I believe in the context of other acts evidence in 90404 is something that is viewed as being somewhat of a suspect argument, that because something happened previously, then it must have happened in this case. But that is not why the evidence was being offered. And I think that is where there really was an issue that was not addressed, and it was an erroneous exercise of discretion, because the reasons why the proponent was offering the evidence was never considered by the trial court. And when it is, it becomes obvious, as it did to the Court of Appeals, that the probative value, that this really was the missing piece of evidence that would have allowed Mr. Sarfraz to obtain a fair trial, because if we're looking at allowing the jurors to hear all of the evidence and make their determination about the nature of the relationship, there was nothing that was going to be done to try to get into the salacious details of the exact sexual acts that occurred. And in fact, the application of, and I would like to correct something that I believe that did not get into evidence but was mentioned earlier in the state's argument, is this issue of Mrs. Sarfraz testifying that she saw them in bed. It was at that point in the record, if it's in the trial transcript, which is the record at 62, where the court stopped the proceedings and did not even allow defense counsel to ask what was seen.
Didn't the court stop it because he believed that the testimony was going to go beyond his order?
I believe that that was the motivation for why, but I think that it was inappropriate because if you are asking a witness what they personally observed, and they observed two people in bed that were naked, that could allow defense counsel then on closing to argue that, well, maybe there was something more to that relationship than was out there. But really the ruling here was that that could not even get into evidence, and I think that's even questionable that that even falls within.
You think two adults would be in bed with no clothes on and there wouldn't be any sexual relationship between the two?
Well, Your Honor, I guess my point is that...
Is that in the record?
That's the argument that's being made, and I find it a little curious, but that's okay.
Well,
I say that tongue-in-cheek. You can ask me.
Yeah. Your Honor, I think what it goes to is my argument is not that necessarily... my argument is that there's nothing in the record that would allow defense counsel to even get up and argue that there was a sexual relationship.
But that's what the trial court prohibited by his order. Now, the trial court may be wrong, and that's what we're here to decide. But given the trial court's order that they could talk about a relationship, that the relationship was of longstanding and they cared for each other, but you couldn't talk about sexual conduct, I mean, for the trial court to say, saw them both in bed and not to stop it, and I don't see how you could comply with the trial court's order if defense counsel were permitted to elicit testimony that they didn't have any clothes on.
Well, Your Honor, I suppose it goes down to the nature and purpose of the Rape Shield Act and the exception that we are talking about.
Right, and even the trial court may be wrong, but I think given what the trial court ruled, he pretty much had to stop the proceedings at that particular point. I mean...
I would agree with you that the trial court's belief that this would even get into something that could touch on that, and I guess that is indicative, and my point of bringing that out is that it's indicative of the fact that that the court was weighing this credibility battle that was going on in this trial in favor of the state, because you had not only there was no ability to even confront on that issue, and if defense counsel got up, and I guess it's indicative of the fact too that the trial court was very sensitive, almost to the point of not letting the jury hear anything that could be extrapolated out to be relating to sexual conduct, which I don't believe technically fits within the definition of the Rape Shield Law, but ultimately it just shows that there was evidence that was out there that could have been incredibly probative to whether you believed Mr. Sarfraz's version of what happened.
Isn't that the whole purpose of the Rape Shield Law? Is not to subject a complaining witness's assertion of rape as being not credible because obviously she's been involved in sexual conduct before? I mean, isn't that the whole purpose, is to keep from questioning that she made a honest statement about what occurred?
Your Honor, I believe that the general purpose of the bar is that, but it is also the purpose that the legislature viewed there being certain instances when exceptions would apply and where they would be so necessary to doing justice in the court systems that we would view this evidence, and unlike some states' rape shield laws where they have no exceptions and they're judicially created, this law actually has exceptions, and in order to administer those things, the Jackson-DeSantis test, I believe, really handles that appropriately because they're both the second and third prong of the test are really grounded in the evidentiary rules that apply any time evidence is getting in at trial. So
an exception to the rape shield is sexual conduct with the defendant.
Correct.
Right? We're not talking about third parties, but with defendant. then you add on to that the DeSantis-Jackson test, right?
Correct.
And then you get to materiality. That's where we started. What is it material to?
But, counsel, I would like to ask you, you started out when in your colloquy with Justice Rogensack, and I'm hopeful that Mr. O'Brien might be able to address this when he gets the rebuttal opportunity, where I thought you were going, and you tangentially addressed it, but you never came out and said it, is in paragraph 5 of the Court of Appeals opinion, where it says, the dissent mischaracterizes the nature of the defense, particularly when it says, Sarfraz argues that sexual contact was consensual before, so it must have been consensual this time, too. In fact, the extremely intimate nature of the entire prior relationship is material not only to whether I.N. consented to or initiated the contact here, but also to whether there was any reason for and whether Sarfraz, in fact, did wear a mask, give a false name when he came to her door, identified himself as the landlord, Jim, as opposed to who he was, or force I.N. to do anything as an unwilling participant. That's where I thought you were headed. Isn't that a stronger argument than...
Yes, it is, Your Honor, and that is ultimately... I guess my point in bringing up consent is that the trial court was concerned with tying this to an element of the crime, or actually all of the elements.
It seems to me that the trial court was concerned with comparing the nature of the alleged prior conduct with the nature of the alleged inappropriate, legally inappropriate conduct. And another point that I'm hopeful that Mr. O'Brien will address on his rebuttal is, how could a defendant, if that is the law, if that is a correct interpretation of the law, how could a defendant who is accused of using force to obtain a sexual gratification ever use the prior consensual relationship as part of the defense? You know, because, of course, anyone who's accused, I mean, well, there would be a great temptation on the part of the defendant to say, oh, yes, you know, it was consensual this time, and my evidence of that is all these other times that we had this, she and I had this conduct. But if that evidence is excluded because of its difference in kind, you know, Mr. O'Brien used the word loving. Loving, I would use consensual or mutual, whatever, as opposed to a violent attack. Well, that'll almost always be the case.
Yeah, I think that the state's, I think you've hit on a problem with the state's interpretation of the law, because it does impermissibly narrow the situations, because you essentially have the state defining what the evidence could be relevant to. And it can only be relevant to the charged conduct, which would be a forcible rape. I mean,
and
that,
it could, and one step further, it seems to me, and I'm, you know, I, if someone wants to educate me, I'm fine with that. But it seems to me it has to go even a step further, according to what I'm hearing, which is the prior conduct has to be of a similar factual type of the conduct alleged in the criminal complaint or information.
Correct. And that is, I think, the biggest problem with that being the interpretation, because if it is, then this will narrow this exception basically out of existence. And we have to remember that the legislature did act in passing this exception when they passed the general bar. So any discussion about this being against the purpose, we have to look at that through also the exception. And I believe that going further to your point, my point in arguing that consent was what this was framed as, and also viewing this as the whole nature and the credibility of the
witnesses. What do you mean consent as what the you mean for the defense? defense framed it as consent. Okay, yeah.
Because the trial court wanted it to be tied to an element. And if you look at the record, the trial court was basically wanting defense counsel to put this into what is the ultimate fact that will disprove either one of the elements of the crime or an element of the affirmative defense. And my argument is that the credibility issues and all the other issues that you mentioned earlier, that this evidence also went to.
Why? I'm lost on Justice Gableman's question to you.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time, Justice.
I'm going to try to get unlost.
All right.
Okay. Why does their having had a prior sexual relationship bear on whether she told the truth that he had a mask on or whether he told the truth that he didn't have a mask on? I don't see the connection,
well,
to be honest with
can
you.
Can I answer that?
No. Not unless you want to walk down there.
You can. I think there's room.
So you can help me out, but he cannot.
Sure.
At least later he might.
We get to talk later, yes.
Yes, that's right. So
well,
go ahead.
I think that it goes to more than just that, Your Honor. I think it goes to not only the issue of the mask. It goes to the issues relating to whether you believed that they had an argument over whether they were going to get married over this issue. Because Mr.
With all due respect, Justice Rogensack is asking about the mask. And I don't understand why your response to her is, hey, if they had a consensual relationship before, why would he have to use a mask to obtain entry into the apartment this time?
Correct. I mean, that's the other... Thank you, Justice Gable.
You're welcome.
No, but I do believe that that's not the only issue, though.
It doesn't matter whether it's sexual or not. You have a lot of people that you know that come and knock on your door, and if you know them, they probably, you know, don't need a mask to be let in. It doesn't have anything to do with sexual, as far as I'm concerned.
And I suppose, Justice Rogensack, that is why I leaped from the, you know, from the issue of entry to the issue of being in the house and arguing, being in the apartment,
arguing. The argument part, I get.
Because, and we can't forget that this not only is an instance where the rape shield law acted to bar evidence, but it also acted to allow the complaining witness to define the nature of their relationship as being a brother-sister relationship. And Mr. Sarfraz's defense counsel had no ability to question or confront her regarding that. He was able to ask whether it was a romantic relationship, but without that missing piece of this prior consensual sexual relationship between the two, his version of there being any of these motivations to want to cause Mr. Sarfraz to leave his wife and kids and support her with some additional money to send back to Pakistan, that all becomes a lot less believable because your perception of the nature of this relationship is that, well, it's unlikely that they would have had such a blow-up argument over this. It's unlikely that it would have led to this. And it's probably more likely that he would have to come with a mask and that it was some sort of unrequited love. And you can see from the question that the one juror asked during or actually after the testimony of Mr. Sarfraz, that this was a question that the jurors had in their mind. It was something that they were concerned about, and they wished to hear whether there was something there. And I'd like to point out...
Well, his conviction was for less than he was initially charged with, though. Correct?
True.
Second-degree sexual assault. He was charged with first degree, wasn't he?
I believe he was always charged with a second degree, but...
Oh, okay.
But one additional thing that I would like to point out is that when you're considering the probative value of the evidence that was not in, there was no other way for Mr. Sarfraz's counsel to portray this relationship in a real meaningful way to answer the questions that the jurors obviously had about the nature of that relationship. And without that, it most certainly led to, and I believe that this is why the Court of Appeals did not particularly address the harmless error argument, is that the error, because it got over the bar of the 90403 or reverse 90403, that it was so incredibly probative, that it was this missing piece of evidence, that there's no way that it could be harmless error. Because ultimately, what you're looking at is you're weighing the and you're weighting in favor of the state this question of credibility by not allowing that evidence to get in and not allowing even argument that this was something more than just a brother-sister relationship. There was also nothing in the record to show that this was meant to be questions that would humiliate or would embarrass. You know, there's ways under the third prong of this test that would allow the trial court to let in and use its discretion to let in some evidence so that there's not this type of harm that occurred in this case, which is that there was nothing that got in. So the trial court did not properly even get to the third prong of this test, but if it had, it would have been able to use its discretion to, if it was concerned about the issues of embarrassing or unfairly prejudicial to the victim, to narrow the evidence that could have gotten in and maybe have resulted in a fairer trial. But that is certainly not something that Mr. Sarfraz got in this case, and that is why I would ask that you respectfully affirm the Court of Appeals decision and reverse and remand this case.
Would you do anything different in the Court of Appeals decision? Is it something we could, even if we hold your way, correct in it or add to it?
Your Honor, I do think that this court could clarify under the second prong of this test that
which prong? Under DeSantis-Jackson?
Correct.
Okay.
That
which prong is that? Materiality?
Yes.
Yep.
That materiality is akin to relevance.
Is akin
is relevance. Or the language that's used in the statute is that it's material to a fact at issue, so I believe that this court would have to follow the language of the statute, but I do believe that material to a fact at issue really means relevance, and that's really the inquiry that this court has essentially made in Sullivan and some other cases that I believe could be clarified so that courts are not under this misimpression that under the second prong of the DeSantis-Jackson test that it has to be, in order for it to be material, if the magic word consent is said, well, then it has to be the same or substantially similar. That's simply not the position that the court should analyze whether that evidence gets in. It should be viewed at from, as essentially any other offer of proof, from the position of the proponent of the evidence, why that evidence is being offered. So that would be my suggestion, Your Honor.
I have another question for you. In your brief on page 66, in your conclusion, you say you respect the court vacates his judgment of conviction and remands the matter for a new trial based on the errors in applying the rape shield. Alternatively, you ask that the court remand the matter for a post-conviction evidentiary hearing regarding effective assistance of counsel. At the very least, you want the court to vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing. Is that right?
Your Honor, I believe that, and I see that my time is up. May I finish?
Yes.
I believe that you're looking, was it page, what page was it?
Oh, am I looking at a different
I believe that you're looking at the Court of Appeals brief.
Okay. You're absolutely right. And the reason I'm looking at the Court of Appeals brief is because in your brief to, and I pulled it specifically, in your brief in this court, you say on page 37, you request court affirm the Court of Appeals decision and remand the matter for a new trial. In the alternative, if the court reverses the opinion of the Court of Appeals on the rape shield law issue, then you respectfully request that the case be remanded to the Court of Appeals for consideration of issues set forth in his initial appeal brief, but not decided by the Court of Appeals. That's why I went to the Court of Appeals brief. So I want to know, if you lose here, what are we sending it back to the Court of Appeals for, in your opinion?
You'd be sending it back to the Court of Appeals to consider the issue of whether the denial, outright denial of the post-conviction petition without a Mockner hearing was appropriate.
And that's what I had just read from the Court of Appeals. The post-conviction evidentiary hearing regarding ineffective assistance, and you're asking to vacate the sentence. Why?
There were reasons set forth in the brief.
In the Court of Appeals brief. Okay, so it's the two things that you would want to remand on.
Correct, but I would hope that we don't get there.
I understand that. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Brien.
With respect to counsel's point that he only needs to show mere relevance, if this court adopts that rule, then it's effectively reading 971.3111 out of the statute books and overruling State v. Jackson, because it's plain that mere relevance to issues such as consent or lack of credibility is not enough, and that is barred by the rape shield law in general. No, 971.3111 and State v. Jackson require the specific materiality showing, and that is a case-specific, fact-specific, evidentiary, hypothetical showing that a defendant must make, and it's a high burden imposed on him by the state legislature. And that was not met here. And, you know, when we get to this whole issue of what the defendant's wife said, this is another side issue that the judge just wanted to avoid. She did testify at the trial that she caught them in the bedroom together, and that's when the judge stopped the testimony. But that evidence got in. She didn't say they were in bed, but she caught them in the bedroom, and she got so angry she threw her belongings out on the street, and then counsel referred to that again in his closing argument to the jury. It's interesting, in the pretrial hearing, she testified that she caught them in bed together and neither of them had pants on. When Mr. Sarfres was questioned about the same thing at the pretrial hearing, he said, well, I didn't have my pants on, but my wife didn't see me because I had my blanket over me, and the victim did have all of her clothes on. So that would be another trial issue that we'd have to parse out in front of the jury and sidetrack the jury from what really happened on May 15, 2010. And, you know,
I thought materiality was a judicial concept in Jackson and DeSantis.
Well, it's a judicial concept based on what the defendant has proven.
I understand that, but I'm trying to say I don't think it's in the rape shield statute, is it?
Well, 971.3111 says the defendant must show materiality and must show probative value outweighs prejudice. So I think it is required by the legislature, and I think this court correctly read that in DeSantis and Jackson. Just the generic proof that the defendant had sex with the victim before, or in DeSantis, the generic proof that the victim might have made some sort of an embellished or false accusation of sexual assault against someone else in the past is not enough. You got to tie that generic proof to a specific evidentiary theory, and that wasn't done here. This idea that his making her masturbate him in their house while his wife's away proves that she got violent with him on May 15th because he wouldn't leave his wife for her. You know, it's interesting. Unlike Jackson, the sexual relationship never ended here. She was mad in Jackson because the sexual relationship ended, supposedly. Here it didn't end. He was coming over there for more that very day. And they discussed marriage in the past, but they never argued about it. There was never violent outbursts by her. There was never any character flaw of her, any violence, any threat of weapons, any threat to break off the relationship or to cut him off if he didn't leave his wife for her. In fact, he agreed to marry her just on his terms. He would stay married to his wife, but he'd also marry her. So that was still an open issue. So that's all that happened in that relationship. There was no S&M. There was no choking as we had here. There was no cut as we had here. There were no hidden knives as we had here. There was no neighbor seconds after. No, they were the only two people in the apartment. But seconds after Sarfres left, the neighbor, who had no interest in this case, heard and saw the victim screaming half naked, full of blood in the hallway that she had just been raped. So how those prior acts prove what happened that day. So we don't just have the victim's account. We have all kinds of independent physical evidence, medical evidence, evidence obtained at the scene, the corroboration up and down that this was a violent account, and in fact, Mr. Sarfres had to admit it in his trial testimony that this was a violent encounter. And I'm sure it came as big a surprise to him as it came as it was to the trial judge, because he didn't anticipate it based on their prior relationship. So why should a trial judge allow it in to say, you, a jury, should have anticipated it, and you need to know about this so you can draw the reasonable conclusion that because she agreed to masturbate him during their romantic relationship, she therefore attacked him and then agreed to have sex with him on the bloody floor on May 15, 2010.
Do you agree that if you prevail, that it goes back to the Court of Appeals on these issues that the defendant had raised but didn't get a ruling on?
Yes, I agree, because the Court of Appeals did not address them, and they were not the basis of my petition for review.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. In fact, I want to, on behalf of the court, thank Assistant Attorney General O'Brien and Defense Counsel Luchek for their arguments today on the Rape Shield Law and for their briefs. That concludes our hearing on 13 AP 337, State versus Mohammed Sarfres. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when we will have additional oral argument. And the court will meet in the conference room at 3:15.
Chief Justice, colleagues, I'd ask for 3:30 to reconvene.
Does anyone object to 3:30? No objection. We meet at 3:30.